I'm Daniel Gross, Executive Editor at Strategy and Business. Welcome to our podcast, Talking My Book, in which we sit down with authors of exciting new books on business, economics, management, and globalization. Today, our guest is Ryan Avent. Ryan is an economics columnist at The Economist. He's based in Washington now. He's the author of a prior Kindle signal called The Gated City. His new book, which we're here to talk about, is The Wealth of Humans, Work, Power, and Status in the 21st Century. It's being published in September by St. Martin's Press, and we're glad it has brought Ryan to our studios high above Park Avenue. Ryan, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Let me just say from the outset, I really enjoyed the book, and I recommend it to all our listeners.
Thank you.
And, you know, at some level, there's a certain amount of pessimism, and I would kind of put this in the genre of, holy crap, the machines and the robots and the software are going to take all our jobs. You phrase it a little differently, but it's still the same situation where too many people will be chasing too little work. And there's a quote, "The promise of the digital revolution is an end to work." What do you mean by that?
For all of human history, we've had to labor backbreaking work or kind of mind-numbing work in offices, doing things many of us would prefer not to do to put food on the table. And so I think, you know, to the extent that we have a goal as a society, it's got to be that we end up in a world where we're able to kind of pursue the things we want to do and not, you know, feel the kind of constraints of material needs that we can't meet. And technology is the magic that will potentially allow us to do that. The sort of tricky bit, the kind of heart of the book, I think, is that we have to find ways to organize our society and our social safety net and our governments in a way that we still have productive people out there making these things so we can consume them, and then have a way to redistribute it to everyone.
Now, technology has always destroyed jobs when it came about, you know, when we started mechanizing agriculture in the late 19th century, we destroyed all these farm jobs and those people found work in factories and cities. And when we started mechanizing factory work more, people found jobs in services and new industries. What's different about this? It's not simply technology acting alone.
I mean, one is just outright automation. Machines are becoming more and more able to do things that it used to be that only humans could do. In particular, you've got kind of this machine intelligence, which allows computers to drive cars, to recognize human speech, and to pick out and identify pictures, stuff that we used to think would take ages for computers to be able to do. And in addition to that, technology has enabled globalization, which has added, you know, billions of workers to the global workforce. And it's also making a small subset of highly skilled people more productive and able to do the work of many more people. So a single individual in New York can run much more money than used to be the case, or teach many more students all around the world.
So in theory, a machine could be doing my job, or someone in India could be doing it, or one person could be doing the jobs of 10 of me. And yet, the train I was on this morning was so full of workers going to their jobs in New York that I had to stand. The unemployment rate, we just had the jobs report, is below 5%. There are 5.6 million jobs open in the United States, which is close to a record. So what am I missing?
I think what I try to argue is that we are not set up as a society to have a situation in which there could be mass unemployment now. Because people need to work to put food on the table. And so when they are displaced from one position, they have no choice but to get back out on the train, to go find another job. Mm-hmm. And so where we would expect to see the pressure and the strain on workers is not necessarily in employment or unemployment. It's in wages. And that, to me, I think is the kind of defining trend over the past three decades, but really since about 2000. And that has been that for most workers, wage growth has just been at historically low levels. And that, to me, I think is an indicator that we're seeing this sort of disruption.
Okay. So, you know, some of the other books that have tackled some of these ideas really focus a lot on technology. But then you move on to talk about two other broad themes that you might think would not have that much to do with this subject, one of which is, it's a kind of corporate culture, and the other is kind of cities and land. And I want to talk about both of those. But first, you know, you had to talk about this concept of social wealth, which when I read it said, oh, that's corporate culture.
So what I have observed as I've worked on these things is that a lot of the increase in value that we see across the economy, a lot of the growth in the economy is coming from businesses that seem to be really successful at their core competency. And what that increasingly is just figuring out what can be done, manipulating information, and kind of making productive use of it. So, you know, Apple's a manufacturer. I mean, what it actually is a team of incredibly skilled designers and engineers and people who are essentially manipulating information. And when you are doing that today in a highly complex economy, it involves working in teams. It involves communicating with people to make sure that the kind of the information gets where it needs to go and that the decisions are made in an effective way. And so you have really successful corporate cultures that end up being sort of coinciding with these highly profitable firms, and in some case also in cities. And then you have people who are sort of on the outside looking in. And so I think one of the things I've tried to get at the book is that access to these successful cultures is kind of a scarce resource. Mm-hmm. And if you're proximate to these things, you can participate in the benefits of growth driven by technology. If you're outside it, if you're not living in New York, if you're not in these kinds of firms, you aren't taking advantage of it.
We should note that Ryan's publisher, St. Martin's Press, has provided us with two copies of The Wealth of Humans, and we'll be giving away those two signed copies to readers. If you send an email to gross_daniel@strategy-business.com, that's gross_daniel@strategy-business.com, we'll enter you in a drawing for a free copy. Yeah, you know, I thought it was an interesting insight. We say, you know, companies, they're not really, even if they're manufacturers, they're not in the business of processing materials or stuff or moving products around. They're in the business of processing information.
Absolutely.
And so software takes an increased importance in car design, for example. So what implications do you think that has for what makes you as an individual successful in an organization?
Well, I think it changes the skill profile that matters a little bit. It's not just about having, you know, a background in computer engineering or something like that. It's also about being conscientious, sort of figuring out how to work with others and what kind of the social currency of a workplace is, what, you know, how to meet their needs, and generally being attuned to kind of these tacit, you know, things that we don't really write down. And I think also it's about a willingness to live in places where these social networks are important. It's the stuff that's really difficult to communicate, that has to be done in person, that has to be sort of talked about in these meetings with other people where you can kind of, you know, gesture with your hands and scribble on whiteboards. And that's, you know, this is how companies generate their value.
Right. And so that's another one of the paradoxes, is that technology and digitization is supposed to liberate us from the confines of cities, but nobody needs to be anywhere. And yet here you and I are sitting in New York, which has been one of the prime beneficiaries of the boom. You've just moved back from London, another one of the prime beneficiaries of the boom, to Washington. Why do cities matter so much, and how is it that they've retained this ability to create disproportionate value in an era when value can be created and often is created anywhere?
I mean, it is really one of the paradoxes of the digital revolution. I mean, I think the starting place is what we were just talking about, the fact that so much of the communication of complex ideas still really needs to be done in person and needs to be kind of mediated through these corporate cultures. The second is that we've made it really hard to build in these places, and that limits the access to them, makes them scarce. And because they're scarce, landowners are able to gobble up a huge share of the value that's created. And I think, and I argue this in the book, that this limitation, this creation of artificial scarcity is something we're going to see across the economy as a way to kind of protect people's wealth from the disruption of technology.
So one of the quibbles I have is that, you know, there's an old line that where you stand depends on where you sit. Which is to say that people like you and I in journalism and media are very sensitive to the disruption caused by digitization because we've seen it happen in our own lives with astonishing quickness and far-reaching effect. In addition, we also interact, if you were living in London, I'm in the New York area, with a lot of people in finance for whom the last decade has been a cascade of sort of failures and then new regulations and institutions no longer existing. So they're often gloomy about the sort of good old days not being there. But in other industries like healthcare, which is growing, its employment is growing like gangbusters, its top line is growing very rapidly, its bottom line is growing very rapidly. You could point to smaller industries, clean technology, infrastructure. Jim Cramer, like I said, there's always a bull market somewhere. So are we, you know, as we, you and I, as we go to these conferences and sit around and talk to other people in media and finance, are we missing part of the story or is this just a matter of time before it hits healthcare and energy and everybody else?
Well, I'm sure we're missing part of the story. But I think you're right. It's not that there are no opportunities being created. Education, healthcare have been top of the list, but there are also things from clean technology to jobs in fracking, which created a short-term oil boom in North Dakota and Texas and elsewhere. I think my perspective on this is that it's the opportunities for mass employment, for people with modest levels of skills that are going to be in short supply so long as wages remain growing for these workers. So there's a trade-off essentially between employment growth and wage growth.
In The Wealth of Humans, Ryan Aven has hit upon an important theme, this idea that behavioral patterns in the workplace matter a great deal. Our colleague here at Strategy and Business, John Katzenbach, has done a great deal of work and research on this topic over the years, and we recently ran an article, 10 Principles of Organizational Culture, by John and a couple other colleagues, which you can find on our website, strategy-business.com. And do you have faith that large employers will sort of say to themselves, you know what, we could automate checkout at every aisle at a Walmart or the ordering of every order at McDonald's, but we're not going to because we're not sure what the return on investment is going to be, but also because this is the way we've done things. Customer service is part of our business, that human interaction is there, and we value our role as a large employer in this country and in this economy. Or is it simply a matter of, you know, they're running spreadsheets and when that number goes into the green, they say, okay, those jobs are gone?
I mean, I'm sure there will be some conscientious firms who are saying, you know, this is part of who we are, providing a customer service experience for our customers. And, you know, we'll do that. I don't think, looking back at the last generation, I'm inclined to say that most big employers have been super generous in that respect. They've been pretty cutthroat in finding efficiencies where they can. I think it'll be interesting as we get to this part of the business cycle. As you talked about earlier, you know, labor markets are tightening up now. They've been slack for a long time. And so if we see rising minimum wage and increased difficulty hiring workers, this will be a test, I think, a bit, the thesis in the book. You know, do firms start to kind of pull off the shelf some of these technologies that could be used to replace workers? I think it won't happen right away because wage growth over the last decade has been pretty poor. And profits have been really high, so they're not going to feel the strain right away.
So, you know, a lot of books in this genre end with a 10-point, you know, enact these 10 policies, you know, most of which, of course, are either absurd or unrealistic or could never happen given our political climate. But you don't do that. You do talk about sort of concept and things that we should be keeping in mind. So what is the, you know, do we sort of hold on to what we have for as long as we have? Do we all think about trying to lead a simpler life or reduce our expenses because we know we won't have work? What can be done?
Well, I just briefly to say why I don't have the laundry list of proposals that usually comes at the end of these. I mean, and that's because I think it's unknowable. And what the Industrial Revolution suggests to us is that there's going to be a period of decades or even generations in which we kind of negotiate with each other what the new status quo is going to be, how we redistribute our wealth, who is entitled to it, who belongs in society and who doesn't. And that's not something I can, you know, foresee how it's going to play out. But looking around, it does seem like there are things we could do to improve the functioning of the economy. I think, you know, wage subsidies are going to be expansions to the earned income tax credit, or maybe even something like a universal basic income.
Right. And so if you are someone who is running a company or at a senior level of a company, the pressures of digitization and technology are obvious, and everyone has an agenda about what they should be doing. But how should people be kind of lifting up their sights from beyond the immediate, okay, how can we digitize this piece of work, or how can we save a few basis points by doing this, so that they are being kind of responsible and useful players in this evolving environment?
Well, it's interesting that you use the adjectives responsible and useful. I mean, I think the profitable thing to do is to kind of reflect on and understand the value, if you're a successful firm, of your culture, and to not try to chase fads at the risk of endangering that, because that's going to be key to your business. Responsible thing, I think, would be to recognize that there is a role to be played by big companies to increase the circle of society that benefits of these things, and that it's not necessarily a good thing over the long run for capitalism or even for the company itself to try to outsource every single thing that can be outsourced, that keeping people within the community of the company and sharing the value that the company generates with them, it would be great if everyone did it. But even if everyone doesn't do it, that could be a thing that companies can do to distinguish themselves from others and to contribute to society in a small way.
Okay, well, that all makes sense. I'm bored with all of that. That's all the time we have for today. Our guest has been Ryan Avent. He's the author of the new book, The Wealth of Humans, Work, Power, and Status in the 21st Century. It's published by St. Martin's. Ryan, thanks so much for coming here today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.